Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 24th of October. Our main stories: President Trump says he'll lift sanctions on Turkey after it completed its offensive in northeast Syria, but he makes no apology for abandoning the Kurds.
We have done them a great service, and we've done a great job. Let someone else fight over this long, blood-stained sand.
Meanwhile, in Washington, Republicans have stormed into a closed-door hearing of the impeachment investigation into the president. And Google says it's achieved a breakthrough in quantum computing. Also in this podcast, Boeing announces a sharp fall in profits following two fatal crashes of its aircraft. And
unaweza kuzungumza Kiswahili?
So, how good is your Kiswahili? Why Tanzania wants to standardize the language. Donald Trump's decision to pull US troops out of northeast Syria has led to a number of consequences which don't necessarily appear to be in America's best interests. Russia increasing its foothold in the Middle East, Syria's President Assad strengthened, and ISIS fighters on the loose. Then there are the 120 civilians dead, as well as 260 Kurdish fighters, America's former allies, of course, and 180,000 people displaced. But President Trump has described what's happened on the Turkey-Syria border as a big success.
Turkey, Syria, and all forms of the Kurds have been fighting for centuries. We have done them a great service, and we've done a great job. It was supposed to be a very quick hit, and let's get out. And it was a quick hit, except they stayed for almost 10 years. Let someone else fight over this long, blood-stained sand.
Our correspondent Jiyar Gol from the BBC Persian Service has just left that part of Syria and is now in the Kurdish area of Iraq. He told me that despite public praise for the Americans from the Kurdish commander, General Mazlum Kobani, there is still real anger in private.
The Kurds had no choice other than pull back. They were hoping the American will reverse their decision and come back and help them because they believe they sacrificed so much. I heard from well-informed a commander within Syrian Democratic Forces that there was a heated conversation between General Mazlum, the commander of SDF, and also U.S. representative. They wanted him not to deal with Russia. And I hear General Mazlum shouted back at them and said, how dare you, are you expecting this from me? You betrayed us, and right now we have no choice other than accept whatever comes on the table. Also, I listened to President Trump's what he said. There was a lot of factual issue I had a problem with. For example, he said that part was unsafe, now is safe. As a matter of fact, the northern Syria, that part was the safest place in Syria. Also, he said, oh, they were fighting that border. There was no fight in that border. I just want to tell you something. 2 days ago, I went to a family just lost their 22-year-old son. He was a member of SDF. He fought ISIS in Manbij and also in Raqqa, but he was killed in Ras Al Ain by Turkish bomb. I talked to the mother. Her name was Mizgin. He showed me a bunch of pictures hanged on the wall. He said, that was my son. That was my brother. That was my niece. That was my nephew. All of them were killed. And he said, why they call us terrorists? Why we were sacrificing 11,000 men and women? Nobody told us then terrorists. Where is humanity? Of course, they were worried. They were nervous. They were telling us, be sharaf, meaning Trump has no moral. He said, they stopped us in the back, and they left us alone in this region. And then how President Trump easily says, well, I have no business, we leave.
Jiyar Gol in Iraqi Kurdistan. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher told me what the American withdrawal and the Russian arrival could mean for the Turkish-Syria border region.
Well, I think, just to get back to what President Trump was saying, I mean, he is endeavouring, I think, for a domestic audience for the election that's coming up more than anything else, to paint what's happened as if it is part of a plan that he had in place before all of these events took over and that America is still calling the shots. I think very interesting that he didn't even mention Russia, and he talked about today's breakthrough. Essentially, these decisions were made yesterday in Russia by President Erdogan and President Putin. The US had no say in this whatsoever. What Gia was saying there also about this having been the safest place, Trump was saying that it would have needed thousands of US troops to see the Turks off. Took a handful of US troops to stop the Turks invading in the first place. So as he was speaking, we've seen today the implementation, the beginning of implementation of that Russian-Turkish plan. We've seen Russian military police convoy going up to the border to Kobani to take over there. We are hearing, again, as Gia was saying, that the Kurds are taking very seriously this deadline they've been given of 150 hours to remove themselves 30 kilometres distance in Syria. So essentially, what Trump, in a sense, put in motion is carrying on, but without any real involvement of his.
Yeah, he also said that ISIS prisoners are secured, but we've heard reports of a number of escapes. Do we know what's happening?
We've been hearing so many different things. I mean, each side is really trying to paint this in their own way. The Turks have been talking about hundreds having escaped. The Turkish foreign minister was speaking today saying that they've managed to hunt down and recapture 200 or so. The Kurds are now saying that they have secured the ISIS prisoners, but they have, that had been their threat, that if the invasion continued, they wouldn't be able to anymore. Before President Trump spoke, a US official essentially undermined what he said again by saying at least 100 are on the loose. So it remains a very unclear situation. What we do know is that some of those ISIS prisoners are getting very concerned that the Syrian government might take them over, might actually arrest them.
Sebastian Usher. Back in Washington, there were chaotic scenes in Congress when Republicans stormed a Democrat-led impeachment hearing held behind closed doors. Morris Jackson, a Republican congressman from Alabama, was one of those involved.
By golly, if they're going to do it in public. Don't hide it from the American people. Show your face where we can all see the travesty that you are trying to foist on America.
The Republicans barged into a meeting room where a Pentagon official, Laura Cooper, was about to be questioned as part of the inquiry into President Trump. The Democrats are looking into whether he abused his power by trying to get Ukraine to investigate his possible presidential rival, Joe Biden. 2 days ago, the president urged his party to get tougher and fight the impeachment inquiry. I heard what happened today from Tara McKelvey in Washington.
Republican lawmakers, they were calling out, let us in, let us in. And they described the whole process as a Soviet-style inquiry. They had their cell phones and electronic devices and other things that are forbidden in a secure area. And basically what they did is they shut down the process, at least temporarily. Laura Cooper, the Pentagon official, was not able to testify at the moment she was supposed to. Eventually things moved on, but there was a lot of commotion and they did have an effect. And what was behind this, a lot of people say, is a deep anxiety among Republican supporters of President Trump. They know that there's growing support for the impeachment inquiry. One of the latest polls shows that 55% of the people in this country support the impeachment inquiry, and it's a significantly higher number in the past. Republicans are worried.
And will they get in trouble for having done this?
Well, they certainly broke a lot of rules with their protest. These electronic devices and cell phones are not allowed in a secured area. These are called SCIFs, and it's an acronym that shows that there's a certain range of space that's protected. And in this space, you can discuss classified information. So cell phones are not allowed. And plus, a lot of the Republican members of Congress who are protesting and saying that they should be allowed in were actually not members of the committees that are listening to this testimony. So regardless of which rules you look at, there's a lot of things that they were doing that would not be allowed under any circumstances.
And what have the Democrats said about it?
The Democrats say that this is another sign that the Republicans are getting increasingly desperate and that the Republicans are really concerned about the impeachment inquiry. And meanwhile, the Democrats are just moving forward. They're requesting additional documents from the U.S. State Department. And in some ways, this has galvanized the Democrats and helped sort of speed this process along.
But do the Republicans perhaps have a point that this stuff should be held in public so everyone can see what's going on?
There's no question that an impeachment inquiry is something that involves the entire nation. And an impeachment process is something that is public and that people across the country can and should see and discuss. But the early phases of investigations, whether they're done by Republicans or Democrats, are done behind closed doors. This allows testimony to include classified information and other types of material that would never be allowed to be presented in public. And later in the process, this is opened up for the entire nation.
Tara McKelvey in Washington. Next to a breakthrough in something called quantum supremacy, a processor able to complete a task 1.5 billion times faster than the best supercomputer, taking 200 seconds instead of 10,000 years. That is what Google claims it's done. Professor Jonathan Oppenheim is an expert in quantum computing at University College London.
It shows they have a lot of control over their device. It shows that they have low error rates. But there's nothing near the kinds of control or nothing near the kind of precision which we would need in order to have a full-scale quantum computer. That's decades away. But it is a really impressive machine, and it's a really interesting milestone.
So what exactly are we talking about? Here's our science editor, David Shookman.
So we hear the phrase quantum computer and imagine it's an enhancement of the computers that we're familiar with. In fact, it's as different as a light bulb is from a candle. You know, I saw one account of how a quantum computer could be 10 million billion times faster than the computers that we're familiar with. And it works in a very bizarre way that harnesses the weird physics down at the quantum scale, in which you don't have to have a switch that's on or off. You can have a switch that's on and off at the same time, which allows you to do calculations which would normally have to be done in succession, one after the other, like in our phones or computers. You can do calculations in parallel on an immense scale, which means you can crunch huge volumes of data very, very rapidly.
OK, well, I won't pretend how something can be on and off at the same time, but, I mean, how will this impact on our lives and how long will it take?
It won't impact our lives for, I think, at least a decade, because although they've made a very significant advance with this announcement, which was done by Google, so you might think there's some corporate spin there, although the results were peer-reviewed and published by the journal Nature, so one assumes that some checks have been done. But IBM, a competitor, has said it's not nearly as grand an achievement as Google Maker. Having said all that, it is a step forward. And it'll probably be, I would say, at least a decade before this very complicated way of doing computing can be handled reliably and put into a sort of use that might affect everyday lives. But if you could apply it, think of the improvement in weather forecasting. That comes down to how many data points, how many calculations can you make in a certain time. Climate forecasts. Absolutely vital. And then perhaps most tangibly for everyday people, new medicines. Because new medicines are about checking billions of possible combinations of different drugs against different conditions. And if you can get a quantum computer to do that for you, it'll be an awful lot quicker.
The BBC science editor, David Shookman. Next to the latest example of people power challenging a government. Large crowds have gathered again in the Chilean capital, Santiago, despite President Sebastián Piñera's attempt to placate them with the promise of ambitious social reforms. A two-day general strike has closed schools, universities and public buildings. Latest reports say 18 people have died during 5 days of violent protests, including a four-year-old child. More than 5,000 people have been detained. The demonstrations were sparked by a rise in public transport prices, but have grown into wider discontent. This report from our South America correspondent, Katie Watson.
Chile has woken up, chanted protesters on Tuesday. They're doing everything they can to get their president out. Listen up, Piñera, they shout, blaming their leader for the country's problems. And it seems the persistence has paid off. Piñera on Tuesday night apologised and announced some concessions, including high taxes for the rich, higher wages and an increase in pensions. Measures that were a long time coming, but whether they'll be enough is unclear. Chileans' anger towards the political elite is palpable.
Chile has lots of money, but it's unfair, totally unfair. My family's middle class, they've worked so, so hard, all by themselves. All I have to say in front of everyone here is that this is unfair and it's not hard. The politicians are the ones who are stealing.
The soldiers remain on the streets. And in a country that lived through dictatorship less than 30 years ago, that makes people nervous. Across Santiago, there were long queues outside supermarkets and petrol stations as people tried to get supplies after days of disruption. But nobody minded. After all, this was for the good of Chile.
Lo que es importante es que el trasfondo de esto es que hay una desigualdad muy grande, hay necesidad de equiparar un poco la torta para todo el mundo y tener un mejor Chile, hacer de este un mejor país.
These past few days of largely peaceful protests have also seen violent standoffs. Tear gas and water cannon used to disperse protesters, some throwing rocks at armoured vehicles. More than a dozen deaths, injuries, and over 2,500 people arrested. Opposition politician Giorgio Jackson says authorities have a lot to answer for.
We are very concerned about, first of all, the human rights issues. We have a lot of repression. We have people dying. We also have people detained, and we don't know their names and the context where they were detained.
The state of emergency in Chile is still in place, as are the curfews around the country. But will Piñera's peace offering be enough to quell the anger on the streets? Chileans will wake up on Wednesday and decide.
That report from Chile by Katie Watson. And still to come in the podcast, the Indian state taking action to narrow the gender gap in births. Boeing has announced a sharp fall in profits following the two fatal crashes of its planes in the past 12 months. Revenue in the third quarter of this year was down 20%, and by some measures, profits slumped by half. Earlier, the families of victims of the crash in Indonesia last October were told by investigators that design and mechanical issues in the Boeing 737 MAX had contributed to the loss of the aircraft and the deaths of the 189 people on board. Here's our transport correspondent, Tom Burridge.
Lion Air Flight 610 crashed shortly after takeoff, after a new flight control system installed onto the 737 MAX repeatedly pushed the plane into a nosedive. According to relatives of those killed, who were briefed by air accident investigators in Jakarta this morning, that new system was a central cause of the crash. Assumptions made by Boeing and the regulators who signed the plane off about how the new system would function and how pilots would react to it were, we're told by families, incorrect. Officials in Indonesia also told relatives that pilots were given no guidance on how to react if the system malfunctioned. However, it's reported that the actions of the pilots on the flight also contributed to the crash. A full crash report is due to be published on Friday.
Tom Burridge. Now to a sound from East Africa. Jumbo, jumbo guana, habari gani, mzuri sana. Tuimbe, tucheze sote. Well, that is Jumbo Bwana, one of Kenya's most popular songs, sung by the group Them Mushrooms in Kiswahili. Although millions of Africans speak the language, more commonly known as Swahili, there hasn't been a globally recognised exam for it until now. Tanzania is considered a centre of Kiswahili excellence, and the University of Dar es Salaam is launching an international proficiency test modelled on similar exams for English, Spanish and Arabic. As I heard from our correspondent there, Sammy Awami.
Kiswahili, especially in Tanzania, is a national language, but also it's one of official languages, for instance, for countries like Kenya, but also worldwide. Kiswahili is believed to be spoken by about 100 million people, and it is the biggest African language. The language is mainly spoken in East and Central Africa, but also in other parts of, for instance, parts of Southern Africa also, there are a few people who speak Swahili. So it's quite an important language.
And why the need for an exam?
So the University of Dar es Salaam, or at least the Institute of Swahili at the University of Dar es Salaam, said it is time that they introduce this kind of like a standard, you know, just like how you have other exams for standards of other languages, for instance, English or Spanish. You have these exams which are, you know, are regarded as standards, you know, for, especially for those who are learning these languages as their second or foreign languages. So they thought it would be important for Swahili to have such kind of a a standardized exam because the language is expanding and countries like South Africa have just introduced this as one of the languages to be taught in their schools.
And how will people in other countries, say Kenya, for example, react to the fact that Tanzania is going to be deciding exactly how Kiswahili should be spoken?
To be honest, I don't think they will be surprised because Kiswahili is believed to have originated in Tanzania. And the Tanzanian Swahili is regarded as better than other Kiswahili or other kinds of forms or dialects of Kiswahili spoken in other parts of Eastern Central Africa. So they may be jealous, but I don't think they are surprised that Tanzania would have this standard or would introduce this standard exam.
And why is the language growing in popularity?
I believe partly, like I said, it is the biggest, you know, African language. And there has been a lot of discussions, for instance, like why organizations like the African Union or the Southern African Development Corporation or other organizations in Africa would not adopt this as their main languages. Because until today, the main languages used as official languages in African countries are still the colonial languages, English or French or Arabic. So there have been arguments like why not elevate, you know, the Swahili language to be as a key or one of the major languages, you know, official languages spoken even by leaders or these political, economical or economic organizations within the continent. So I believe one of the reasons is the status, Swahili being the biggest African language.
Sami Awami in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. The northern Indian state of Haryana is making inroads into fixing its gender ratio after allegations of widespread feticide. Following years of disparity in birth numbers between male and female children, the gap is finally narrowing. Our correspondent Arvind Chabra reports from the village that once had the worst sex ratio in the country.
I have travelled nearly 200 kilometres north of the capital Delhi to the village of Barna. It's a small village by Indian standards with just over 6,000 residents. I have come here to meet Anju Rani, who gave birth to baby girl just last month. She lives in a single-storey dwelling, like most houses in this village. Just outside the house is a pile of drying dung cakes to be used as fuel. Many homes here have resident cows and buffaloes. Anju and her mother-in-law, Mukhidiri, greet me with their faces covered in a veil. But they both look happy with the new addition to the family. They say they prayed for a girl after Anju had twin boys 5 years ago.
Mera poti hui ji. Humne bahut khushi hai ji. Bahut bahut zyada hai. Hamare ghar ki lakshmi hai ji.
I am happy. Very, very happy. She is like a goddess for us. You really need a baby girl at home. We went to many temples to pray for a girl child, and our prayers have been answered.
50-year-old Mukhi is the more outspoken of the two, but her daughter-in-law Anju makes a crucial point.
This world exists because of women. What people don't realize is that where will the boys come from if there were no girls?
The state of Haryana has over the years gained a reputation of manipulating the gender ratio to suit the preference for baby boys. The reason is the costly dowries the parents have to pay to marry their daughters off. As a result, it has become the state with the country's poorest sex ratio, with 830 females against 1,000 males in 2011. The situation had become so bad that the men had to look for and even buy brides for themselves from other states. Nearly 4 years ago, Prime Minister Narendra Modi launched a campaign to save girls in India called Beti Bachao Beti Padhao. Since then, things have changed a lot. The ratio of newborn girls per 1,000 boys went up to 918 till June this year. This village Barna had the worst record 4 years ago when it had 548 females against 1,000 males. Now, the girls outnumber the boys. I asked some women in the village who they attribute this success to. Jyoti Benswal gave birth to a baby girl 3 weeks ago. She says that it's action by the government that has worked.
Earlier, people used to kill girls before birth. But now that has stopped because of strict check on ultrasound centers.
So what do the people involved in the campaign say? I have come to the Kurukshetra Civil Hospital, which is about 10 kilometers from the Barna village. Outside this hospital, I can see a big signboard that has a group of four smiling girls appealing to the people to cast their vote in the upcoming state elections. You cannot miss the focus on women in this state these days. I am at the Deputy Civil Surgeon S.K. Sahai here.
Target ko achieve karne ke liye.
To achieve our targets, we arranged awareness campaigns and rallies at a village level. But our undercover operations were most effective. Our raids on the illegal ultrasound centers that determine the sex of fetuses.
Clearly, efforts to improve the sex ratio have paid off.
But changing attitudes is a slow process in parts of India, where giving birth to a baby boy is still highly prized.
Arvind Chabra in Haryana. A big day now for fans of news and artificial intelligence. The BBC has launched the world's first ever interactive broadcast news service. To begin with, it's only available on Amazon Alexa-enabled devices here in the UK. If you have one, when you ask your device for BBC News, instead of getting a traditional bulletin, you can now skip ahead to the stories you've got time for or find out more about the ones that grab your attention. Siobhan Leahy reports.
Alexa, get me the BBC News.
Hello, this is BBC News. On the way, the latest on Brexit and can Star Wars live up to the...
That's a taste of the brand new, world-first interactive broadcast news service. Now, don't get me wrong, there have been similar projects before by other companies, but they've all involved synthetic robot voices. The BBC says this is the first time you can have a conversational relationship with the news. The idea is to be able to move through a bulletin at your own pace. So if, for example, like many of us, you're fatigued by stories about Brexit...
You're joking. Not another one?
Then all you need to do is say...
Alexa, next.
Or if you've been enticed by a story about President Trump...
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being so patient.
Then you'd say to your device...
Alexa, more from the BBC.
You might be offered more in-depth reporting. Out in the field, you could be redirected to a podcast or even take a moment to enjoy some golden audio from the BBC archives.
It's Sergio Aguero! Manchester City winner!
Don't worry, I'm not just here to blow the BBC's trumpet. There are some serious concerns raised with new technology like this. Some people fear that by self-curating your news, you're potentially missing out on big, important stories, and then the BBC's education remit is somewhat compromised. Well, we put that question to the BBC voice and AI executive editor, Mukul Devachand.
Yeah, and it's a really good thing to worry about. And the way we've designed this is really as a bit of an antidote to that, actually. The order of the stories and so forth is editorially determined, and it's very much guided by those values. And I think we were keen, as AI beds in, and we wanted the BBC to take advantage of it, but also make sure that was done in an editorially trusted way and kind of set a tone for doing that.
And apologies if you're listening to this outside of the UK, because this service is currently only available in Britain. But the BBC Voice and AI team promise they are looking at ways they can bring it to a bigger audience. And if you've made it to the end of this report without screaming next, thank you. But for now, Alexa, stop.
Siobhan Leahy reporting. And you've made it to the end of this edition of the Global News Podcast, but there'll be an updated version later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.